I know you promoted and supported the Lewis and Clark venture, and I wonder what you think would have been the face of the country then and now if they survived miraculously, but they could easily have been defeated at any point and not returned at all. What would have been the U.S. if that had happened?
I don't want to quibble with you, but I don't like to use the word miraculous except in that one specific area of the New Testament. I don't think they survived miraculously. I think they survived by very good planning, and they had some luck. But I take your point that they, at any point they could have died of disease or broken bones or an Indian attack or extreme weather. You know, they weathered in Dakota, and the temperature was 43 degrees below zero with a 40-mile-an-hour wind for a couple of weeks. They could easily have died of exposure. Mr. Lewis was an extraordinary man. He was a protege of mine. He was a neighbor of mine. He lived with me in the White House for 2 years before he made his famous tour. He was as well prepared as anybody could possibly have been for that journey, and it was extremely well led, and probably the greatest decision that he ever made was to hire his friend William Clark to be his partner in discovery. They were effectively co-captains, although not technically so. So if they had miscarried, if they had died out there, and many believe they had because they were almost a year late in getting back, what would have been different? I think almost nothing. It would have been an embarrassment to my administration because the Federalists had been very unpleasant about the Lewis and Clark expedition. They were unpleasant about the Louisiana Purchase, if you can imagine that. I bought 828,000 square miles for 3 cents per acre, and the other party complained. You know, and Hamilton literally said, Mr. Jefferson, why did you buy it when we could have had it for an invasion? We could have just sent out an invading force. And one Federalist newspaper said, Mr. Jefferson has bought land of which we do not need with money of which we do not have. So this is pathetic political. This is why parties are such an idiotic idea, John, because the Louisiana Purchase is maybe the greatest moment in American history. And anybody who has an ounce of sense realizes that you have to buy Louisiana when you get that chance. And for the Federalists to quibble about this shows that they don't have any good sense, that they just want to discredit. So if he had died, it would have been an embarrassment to me, but I don't think that it would have changed the fate of this country. We would have sent out a reprisal force if it had been an Indian attack. Others, when Lewis and Clark came down the river in the fall of 1806, they met at least 14 parties of traders going up. The river was open, and humanity was going to press its way to the Pacific.
Over here.
I read a letter where you had some instructions for Lewis and Clark, and in it you talked about treating Native Americans respectfully, inviting the leaders to Washington, carrying cowpox medicine for them so they would not get smallpox. However, your successors dealt with Native Americans very differently, including Andrew Jackson, as you had mentioned. I'm wondering if the Native American question could have been dealt with differently than it was.
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to it. I do think Jackson was a barbarian, wholly unfit for the presidency. I mean, he was even scarcely literate. He was a vicious dualist and a man of so little education that I think that incapacitated him for high office. I'm not an admirer of his. I should say in honesty that his Indian policies, in some sense, were just an extreme application of policies that were already in the air before he became president. How could this have been done differently? I don't think it could, in some sense, unless we were willing to draw a line somewhere and say this far and no farther for white settlement. But no president could have stopped the waves of settlers, Daniel Boone and his companions, who were pressing farther and farther west. You know, the problem is that we were an industrial, metallurgical culture, the most advanced culture that the world had ever seen up till that moment, and Indians were a Stone Age culture. And they didn't have capacities to resist us. We didn't have capacities to yield. My hope was that we would somehow blend together and that they would be absorbed into us without violence. I realize that's a relatively utopian dream. Our diseases, we couldn't have known this, but our diseases killed more Indians than all of the bullets that were ever manufactured. It's a tragedy that these two races met under such dissimilar systems. And so my hope was simply that we could ease this rather than eliminate it altogether. But if I had said at any point, Americans, Indians are sovereign, we therefore must stop penetrating the West and leave them to their own sovereign existence, I would have been retired from office immediately. The genius of the American people is this restless energy, and you are the direct beneficiaries of it. I don't think that anything could have stopped it. So it's a tragedy. All you can do is to make it better, but you can't make it go away.
And we're going to go over here. Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Jefferson.
Good morning.
I have been demonstrating against the war since June. And although I do get a lot of really good support from passersby, I also have a lot of people gesturing at me. Some people call me a communist. Other people say I'm committing treason. What is your reply to people that might say these things to me?
Well, certainly they're within their right to rebuke you if they think that you are not the sort of citizen that they desire. They have free speech rights too. You know that you're taking a risk when you do these sorts of things. My philosophy comes from Voltaire and the Enlightenment. Voltaire said to a woman, "Madam, I disagree with what you say, but I shall defend to the death your right to say it." I think we should be, even if we don't like what you're saying, I think we should be stopping and congratulating you for being a citizen who really cares about this country, even if we disagree profoundly. If they've called you communists, they're just idiots. You know, you should supply them a little laminated card that explains what communism is. To protest a nation's war has never been seen as a communist act. Whether this is treason or not is of course, a very different question. We need our citizens to be volatile and to be suspicious of their government, and particularly when it's doing adventuresome things in the world. So I don't regard what you're doing as treason. I don't think any rational being could. Anyone who understands the history of liberty shouldn't. And it seems to me that we should regard you as a modest national hero, even if we feel that you are completely misguided about what you're doing. We protested British tax policy in the 1770s, and they said that we were committing treason, and that we weren't good British citizens, and that this, you know, you get the usual run of abuse. If you don't protest, you cannot be free. If you say to your government, you know, we're pretty sure you're doing the right thing, it doesn't look like it, but we're pretty sure you're doing the right thing, then you deserve to be enslaved.
All right, but then what does a patriot do when the patriot's country is at war? Do you, you know, protest, or do you try to propel, try to help?
If you think the war is a just war, you modestly and humbly agree to serve. If you think that it's an unjust war, you march in the streets.
Yeah. Would you guys have had support our troops signs in your yards during the revolution? Because that's three words that, boy, just makes some people crazy.
You know, what John Adams made his national reputation when there was a horrible shooting in Boston. It's called the Boston Massacre, and British troops were goaded by rabbles in the streets into firing upon this mob, and Adams defended the British. This was before the Revolution, but he said, you know, the mob had a right to be there, but the mob was threatening the security of these troops. These are troops of the British Empire. They fired in self-defense. It's a horrible thing, but somebody has to be their advocate in court, and it was a very unpopular thing for him to do. So I think that our principle should be that human beings are free, and if this woman wants to protest the war or protest taxation or protest streetlights, she has a sacred right to do so. And if America doesn't have protesters, you know it's not a free country anymore. It's that simple, because no country in history has ever been so well governed that there aren't people who are discontented.
Good question. Thank you. We're going to go up top here now, and say we have a young person there. Hi.
Hi. What do you think about the complexities of funding the educational system of a country the size of the U.S.?
Well, you are a very well-educated person. I regard education as a very private matter. You know, that if you have two sons, I believe.
Yeah.
So you're the primary educator of them. Mm-hmm. Then you and I, if we're neighbors, might band together and hire a teacher. But I see education as profoundly local. I don't see it as a state question. I don't see it as a federal question. I see it as a local question.
Yeah, well, we have public schools now.
Public schools, but they should be locally administered, and the curriculum should be locally determined.
Should they all have equal facilities, and should that be...
No.
No?
Because if you and I, let's say you and I and six of our neighbors form a school, we might want our children to learn to believe that God is a Trinitarian God, and that we should have the right to teach our children that. If we want to teach our children that the moon is made of blue cheese, we have a right to teach that. This is the most sacred thing, a parent and his child. The state has no interest in what we teach that child. And if the people next door are atheists or agnostics or Unitarians and they want to teach their children that, or if they want to concentrate on mathematics and engineering rather than the arts and the humanities, that's their sacred right. It's not in the interest of the state to dictate to private individuals what they shall teach their children.
Well, maybe on matters of faith, but we all want our kids to know the three R's.
Then you should teach them.
No, I got to go to work. I'll
Then you should hire a teacher who supports your philosophy.
Well, I've sort of done that. I pay my taxes and then I build a school and the kids go to the school there. So I've kind of let them do that. That's okay, right?
Well, you've created a mass factory model of public education, and Mr. Hamilton would be pleased.
We're going to go back over here on the floor. Hi.
Thank you, King John, for putting this gathering together for all of us.
Ex-nay on the King's.
President Jefferson, do you have any thoughts on the illegal immigration problem that's facing our nation at this time?
I've gotten a little tripped up on this King thing.
I'm sorry. I should have asked you to cover your ears. I'm sorry.
thank you.
I believe in open borders. Of course, I lived in a very different time, but I believe that if you're accidentally born in Chicago, you know, you had no role in this. This was not choice. You are accidentally born somewhere in the world. I think you have a natural right to emigrate from the place of your accidental birth to one of your liking. So if you have a right to migrate, you have a corollary right to be absorbed by another society. Every society then determines the rules by which newcomers, immigrants, will be absorbed. And a society does have a right to say that too much immigration, too little. In other words, the United States or Canada or Mexico has a right to determine under what conditions it will allow outsiders to come in. But I believe it's in the interest of every nation to have a generous policy of immigration. But we also have a right to have a probationary system so that every new immigrant becomes an American. They have to know our language. They have to know our Bill of Rights, our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution. It would be ludicrous to say, come here, but you don't need to accept our social compact. If you come here, you must be so well trained in the social compact, our constitutional system, that you are effectively as well prepared as the person who's lived here for five generations. And a society has a perfect right to do this, and I think you ought to do it, and otherwise you're jeopardizing your national security.
Thank you.